officially get started. I'll call the meeting to order. It is a joint hearing again. What we're wanting to do today is a follow-up on the livestock study. I know when the MDA was up here, we had a lot of questions that were starting to arise, and so we made the decision that we would just suspend it that day, call them back, and if this meeting takes 10 minutes or, you know, an hour and a half, it's up to all of you. But I wanted to make sure that we took the time to get everybody's questions answered, and I believe we do have some testifiers coming in as well. We have some special people we want to recognize here today, and where'd the other resolution go? So while Representative Clark's reading over hers to get familiar, Representative Bennett, would you like to recognize some folks?
I would love to. Thank you so much. I actually have some people from Albert Lee here from the County Road Cattle. And I was wondering if they could just kind of come stand up in here. There's quite the group
sure,
of them.
Come on up.
And I will read this resolution.
Welcome to the committee, everybody.
And I just want to thank all of them for coming. These people have developed just a wonderful cattle business and program, and I will read the resolution here, which is signed by Kurt Dowd, Speaker of the House, Joyce Pepin, our Majority Leader, and Rod Hamilton, our Chair of the Committee. So I'll just read this resolution if we could. It says, a House resolution recognizing County Road Cattle and its founders for their commitment and contributions to Minnesota agriculture. Whereas County Road Cattle's mission is to develop high-caliber herd of cattle with exceptional genetics, to breed and sell quality show and breeding stock, and to mentor the next generation of cattlemen. And whereas County Road Cattle utilizes rotational grazing, a management-intensive system of raising livestock on subdivided pastures called paddocks, which improves animal productivity and temperament, increases plant persistence, and conserves environmental resources. And whereas County Road Cattle, is founded and owned and operated by three generations of farmers, I think that's pretty awesome, consisting of Marty Little, Richard Stadheim, Bennett Stadheim, Megan Peterbow, Drew Peterbow, Garrett Stadheim, and Al Johnson. And by the way, if I could add into this, that the generations go from high school all the way to grandparent.
Very nice.
Whereas they are continuing the tradition of training the next generation of cattle breeders and growing their herd of quality Angus, Hereford, Maine, I'm not going to get these names right, Maine, thank you, and some Memento cattle. Now, therefore, let it be resolved by the Committee on Rules and Legislative Administration of the House of Representatives of the State of Minnesota that it commends County Road Cattle for their contributions to Minnesota agriculture and wishes them continued success in the future. So, thank you.
Let's congratulate. So, well, thank you so much and congratulations. Representative Bennett, would anybody like to say a couple words?
Would anybody be interested in just saying a few words? Or
put them on the spot.
Yes, we'll put you on the spot.
That's what we do here.
Well, I guess I thank you guys for recognizing.
You want to come to the mic and just state your name for the record?
Yeah.
Hey, we have some time today. We're going to put you on the spot.
They told me I had a face for radio, though. No, I just thank you for recognizing us. I thank you, Bennett, for bringing this up. It's been a fun venture. It started out as just a 4-H project for our youngest son, who then got our daughter and older son involved, and Marty was kind of our mentor, and I would probably say Al is a little bit of Marty's mentor. So we've just kind of all mentored down, and we hope to continue that, and hopefully we can continue with the 4-H program and helping young students get involved. And I think it's a real good, gives them real good responsibilities, and hopefully keeps their nose clean. And I just thank you once again.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, everybody. Thank you, Representative Bennett. We have another individual or group, Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think, Michael Cheney, where are you? There you are. I think they want you to go stand over here while you get
recognize, and they're bringing with you some of the folks that are here.
Yeah, front and center, Mr. Cheney.
Collaborators there. So, this says, a House resolution honoring Michael Cheney on his service to Minnesota agriculture. Whereas, Michael Cheney is co-founder of Project Sweetie Pie, an urban farm movement designed to promote healthy food and physical activity in urban areas and to promote economic opportunity in the food distribution system. And whereas, under Michael's leadership, Project Sweetie Pie, with over 30 urban gardens and 130 partners in Minneapolis, has impacted more than 1,000 kids and community members and has more than 250 organizational partners. And whereas under Project Sweetie Pie, more than 2,000 sweet potatoes, tomatoes, onions, cabbage, lettuce, kale, pumpkins, and peppers have been planted. And whereas the organization has organized master gardeners who are instructing kids about planting and harvesting, supported the youth cafe at North High, raised produce sold at community farmers markets, and inspired community members mentoring kids on social entrepreneurism and mechanics of food distribution. And whereas the organization has been recognized by Mayor Betsy Hodges for helping revitalize neighborhoods, promote healthy lifestyles, and help advance equity. And whereas it has helped young participants, many who are in dire financial need, acquire skills to help them feed their families and brought together diverse populations. And whereas it is one of five national grant recipients from the United States Council of Mayors, which awards grants to local communities to help bring gardens and public green spaces to neighborhoods throughout the country. And whereas prior to his work with the organization, Michael worked for KMSP-TV and the Wendell Phillips Community Development Federal Credit Union, and has also started the Juneteenth celebration in North Minneapolis. Still going. And whereas a dedicated volunteer, community organizer, and activist, he was also an 11 Who Care honoree by Care 11 News, characterized by passion, persistence, and a love for his community. Now, therefore, be it resolved by the Committee on Rules and Legislative Administration of the House of Representatives of the State of Minnesota that it congratulates Michael Cheney on his outstanding contributions to Minnesota agriculture. And it's signed by Kurt Dowd, Speaker, Joyce Pepin, Chair of Rules and Legislative Administration, and Ron Hamilton, our own Chair and State Representative.
Please state your name for the record.
I'm Michael Cheney. I knew I should have worn my cowboy hat. You know, in thinking about, you know, first of all, I'd like to thank you all for this honor. You know, oftentimes, you know, one's hard work goes unanswered, right? But I appreciate you guys' efforts in terms of realizing that just as those ladies and gentlemen were trying to do something for their community, that communities all across the state, regardless of race, creed, and color, have the same aspirations. And so through your support in this upcoming bill, we hope to realize, you know, some of those rewards as well, not just for Project Sweetie Pie, because we're just a collaboration of a lot of different Northside organizations and leaders. So thank you for honoring this, and let's see if we can plant some sweet potatoes.
Yes, please state your name for the record. And
hi, my name is Bruce. I don't know how you brought this out of here.
Oh, okay. We don't either. This was the first call.
My name is Bruce, and I'm from Pride in North Minneapolis. It's a youth program that we have that we just started over there. And I've been knowing Michael for 20-plus years, you guys. And when they first started planting these gardens in the neighborhood, I'm just going to say neighborhood, and when they first started planting these gardens, I was like, wow, this is a cool concept, but our kids aren't going to get it. A few years later, my man, I see kids out in those things, out in the gardens, helping planting, and it is just so cool. This year here, we're hoping to have a lot of our kids from Pride in North Minneapolis working, also working at the farmers market, also helping planting, just the whole nine yards with it, because we feel that, you know, I mean, it's not what comes out of your, it's not what goes into your mouth that's going to make you dirty. It's what comes out of your mouth. So we feel that if we can get kids to eat proper, to live proper, I believe that they would be productive members of society, you know, in these neighborhoods. So I want to thank you, Mike. I truly want to thank you, you know, publicly, because, man, you are an inspiration and a motivation to a lot of us. So thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
I don't know if I mentioned it, but we did get recently from the University of Minnesota, we got a $50,000 grant to do proof of concept. There's a greenhouse on Dowling in Humboldt that, you know, we refer to as the cookie cart on steroids, the, you know, the arboretum of the north that we, again, when we started birthing this idea, we had it in mind that we wanted to create this urban farm campus. And so in our $50,000 grant that we got from the university, we're looking at four pathways to higher education, four pathways to success. One, we're looking at composting and soil science. So actually we've got bought a bunch of soil testing equipment, and we're going to start working, testing all the lots in North Minneapolis. We're looking at aquaponics, we're looking at STEM curriculum, and we're looking at greenhouse maintenance and management. So we're on the road. We ask for your support in helping us realize, you know, what's been, you know, a five-year ride. So thank you.
Mr. Cheney, did you say that was located on the corner of Dowling and Humboldt?
Yeah, Dowling and Humboldt. It's actually, our story is kind of a Will Allen story. I don't know if folks know about Will Allen, but he's kind of the grand poopa of the urban farm movement. Actually, 15 years ago, I approached Will and said I wanted to bring his curriculum to North Minneapolis in northwest Wisconsin, where I had a 140-acre farm. Because I was so impressed with the work that he was doing. He won a MacArthur Award, the Genius Award, and he's last year signed a $1 million contract with Walmart doing neighborhood composting. So he's been, but so this greenhouse is one of the oldest greenhouses in the metro area. It's owned by the Murphy family, and so we want to acquire that and maintain it. It's actually already zoned agricultural, and so we want to maintain that longstanding tradition and carry forward. So,
well, Mr. Cheney, I was born and raised in Humboldt, Iowa, so I think that's a sign. I'm just saying. All right. Thank you so much, and congratulations, Mr. Cheney.
All right. Thank you.
We'll move right into the agenda. If we could bring up the Department of Agriculture once again. And so, Ms. Place, you want to get us started here? And I think what we'd like to do is we cut the testimony a little short. So if you want to just, familiarize us, give us a condensed version with the update or the overview, and then we'll go ahead, because I think we have some people that want to testify, and I'm sure we'll have some questions. So Ms. Place, state your name for the record and who you represent.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Whitney Place. I'm the Director of Government Affairs at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Thank you for having us back again to discuss the livestock industry study that we wrote this past year. We have Kurt Zimmerman today to testify about the study. He's the livestock supervisor at the department.
All right, Mr. Zimmerman.
Thank you, Chairman Hamilton and members of the committee. I appreciate the chance to come back and answer some additional questions. Again, I would offer that if you have questions about our livestock industry study after the hearing or in the days or weeks to follow, we'd be more than happy to try to get you that response. There were two or three questions that were brought up when I testified here a couple of weeks ago, and I wanted to just make sure that I got the proper answers. Representative Miller, you had a question about the livestock inventory numbers and how we accounted for livestock operations that were headquartered in one state and maybe had operations in multiple states. I did check. The Ag Statistics Service, when they do their surveys, do contact the owners of the operations. Now, let's just say Golden Plump. They have operations in Minnesota, South Dakota, Wisconsin, possibly some others. They respond about the livestock operations, or in that case, the turkeys that are grown for them in various states in their report. And then that information is disseminated, and the estimates are actually shared by the other states. So we don't double count them. It's actually where the livestock reside, not where their ownership. So I just wanted to clarify that. Representative Clark had a question about the Department of Ag's response in pesticide drift. We had one of the lawsuits over the past 10 years involved pesticide drift for a crop, and the Department of Ag is very involved in that. Pesticide drift is illegal, and we would investigate that to the full extent, and if there's a violation, we would incur penalties for that. So we're very involved in that part of it. Again, the purpose that the livestock industry study is all about is right in the very executive summary section, the very inside cover. And we were asked by this committee last year's session to identify causes of relative growth or decline on poultry and livestock in six states: Minnesota, North and South Dakota, Iowa, Nebraska, and Wisconsin. We were asked to do that over the past 10 years. So when we sat down to put this study together, which was last July when we first started, we had to narrow our focus into the last 10 years. There's been some questions brought up in the last time we gathered with the committee regarding pending lawsuits and litigation that's out there in the livestock industry. Again, that's issues that are very important and very real. But again, it's from today looking forward, and I believe you will have testimony regarding that. We are aware of some of the pending things that are happening not only in our state, but also in Iowa and elsewhere. We also had questions regarding some specifics with our environmental permitting and review section, and we have representatives from the Pollution Control Agency here to respond to those. So I believe we're going to be able to answer the questions and some of the concerns that we had in the last time we met. And if there's other additional questions you have from the perspective of our study or the Department of Agriculture, I'd be happy to respond to them at this time.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Zimmerman. We're going to, if members have questions along the way, just please make sure you get noticed right away, and we'll ask questions as we go. We are going to, Mr. Zimmerman, I think what we're going to do now is we've had some people travel quite a distance to come in here and testify, so I want to move them up to the top of the list if we could, make sure that they're heard in the time that we have allowed, okay? So don't go too far away. At this time, I'm going to call, is there a Ms. Walsh? Yes, if you'd please come down. Yes, and then after Ms. Walsh, we'll go to Mr. Schoenfeld. So Ms. Walsh, if you would please state your name and who you represent for the record, and begin, please. And if we can get her some assistance with that.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, just speak
that,
right in the
is
mic.
Is that better?
Yeah,
that's
thank
better.
You.
My name is Amy Walsh. I am representing really my mother here today. I understand that the MDA report studied the impact of nuisance lawsuits on agriculture, and I have personal experience with this, and I just wanted to offer a few comments. So, thank you for hearing me this morning. We amicably lived amongst multiple pig farmers for decades. When they cleaned out their barn, it was just part of the rhythm of the seasons. It never entered our minds, never crossed our minds to bring a nuisance lawsuit. We have even had pigs ourselves. I grew up on a farm. I love farming. It is deep in my heart and my soul. I am not used to the type of farming that hurts people. But now we have experienced farming that hurts and hurts deep. I don't know if you can all see the CAFO there. I'm just going to step around and point here to my mom's and to the facility.
And Ms. Walsh, if you need some help as well, we have some folks that can help you with that.
So this is my mom's house where I grew up. And this is not even fully built out yet. There's more additions here, but this is the last available aerial of the CAFO. So it's, as you can see, quite a huge building.
There is a horrible stench that comes from this building, and the exhaust fans are lined up right to our house in parallel. It's unlike any other ag smell I've ever smelled, and it reeks, and it's miserable, and it's reeked at Christmas and at Easter. and on my birthday, and on my mom's birthday, and on the 4th of July, her favorite holiday. And it has had a horrible stench on the anniversary of my dad's death, and he loved that land. It stinks on weekends, weekdays, holidays, mornings, afternoons, nights. I can't explain to you what it's like to not have the little slice of heaven that we had before they built become a misery zone and drive us back indoors. I'm not a litigious person, but here we have launched a nuisance lawsuit. It's not an easy process. There are depositions and affidavits and subpoenas and productions of documents and hearings, and we are facing trial. It's not easy. For us, it was a hard decision. It's hard to go through it. But I just wanted you to hear this side of ag. And I said it before, I love ag. It is deep in my soul. I grew up on it. I don't know what it's like to sit in your chair. I'm asking you, to the extent that you're able, to think about what it's like to sit in my chair, in my mother's chair. If you have to walk in my shoes, if you would think about what it's like to walk in my shoes, I don't think you would even consider putting legislation around eliminating the possibility of nuisance lawsuits. I don't take it lightly. Thank you for hearing my testimony.
Thank you, Ms. Walsh. Any questions for the testifier? Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thanks for testifying, Ms. Walsh. Just have to ask, did the hog barn in your picture, a lot of these are permitted locally. Could you talk about the process locally and how it was permitted, and are they doing the things that they said they would do to minimize some of these situations?
They did have to go through a permit process. We understand that part of that was an air monitoring trailer. They've said that they can't find an air monitoring trailer, and so that just kind of got waved under the rug. We've begged them to use biofilters. We've offered different, you know, this has a solution, this has this type of biofilter, that type of biofilter. They refuse to say that, use them, say they're too expensive. We've sought other remedies. You know, yes, air monitoring was part of the conditions. They say they can't do it and nothing happens. There's a great, great deal of problem with enforcement.
Chair Anderson.
No.
Ms. Walsh, you said the site, they didn't go through the permitting process. They don't have a permit. Did I hear that accurate?
No, they have a permit. But in particular, the air monitoring piece of the permit hasn't, to my knowledge, it hasn't been enforced.
Okay. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your testimony, Ms. Walsh. I'm curious about the follow-up. First of all, what county is this in?
This is Todd County.
Representative Anderson, or Johnson, excuse me.
Thank you. We were joking about Anderson Johnson just a moment ago. Anyway, does the county, and maybe this requires someone else, but does the county have any process for a citizen to complain about problem odors associated with a livestock barn?
Ms. Walsh, would you like to answer that question, or we could have somebody else come up as well?
My experience, and you know, this is my experience in complaining and saying, hey, this is a problem, we just get kind of brushed aside, and we've complained to the MPCA. They've come out and said that, you know, so before the barn was built, we were told or estimated in the EAW that there was like 15 parts, and I forget if it's parts per million or parts per billion, but it was 15. Before they ever built, they said it was 15. After they built and were operating, they came out and said that it was zero. How is that possible?
Representative Johnson.
Yeah, I guess this is more of a comment. I last year when this was coming up, I checked with the local environmental office of my county, where I live, and there's a mechanism there for if you live near a barn, and you think the odors are bad, you actually can. There's a process done through the county, through the local folks, to monitor that and to identify the times when the odors are worse, and then this can be pursued. There's a process to pursue that. And I'm just wondering how common, this is probably a question far larger than you, Ms. Walsh, but I think it's relevant to this committee. How common are those processes? How well do those work? Are they well received? And so there's that set of questions, and then the questions that were raised about the siting, same question. You know, it appears that it varies county by county, and again, I would argue that careful siting of barns just makes good sense. It takes time, but in the long run, to avoid these sorts of conflicts, if we can carefully site. And so I guess if we're going to pursue this issue, it would be what are the protections available county by county, and how can those be improved so everyone's heard in it? Final note, I did follow up with my county and learned that though these issues are sometimes pursued and people start monitoring the days and the times when the orders are bad, that frequently it seems to get resolved on its own. And I'm curious about that as well. But I think those two questions of county by county siting to make sure people are protected, and then ongoing opportunities for monitoring that seem to diminish the conflict associated with the barn. So,
well, thank you, Representative Johnson. Ms. Walsh, is Todd County, is it a delegated county, or how large is this facility for animal units? Do you know?
It's 1,442 animal units.
So on 1,442 animal units,
it's roughly 4,000 pigs.
So then that would have to go through a permitting process through the state, through the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency?
It did, and we made our voices heard there.
Ms. Walsh, okay. All right. And they went through an EAW as well, Ms. Walsh?
Yes, they did.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions for the testifier? Any other questions? Ms. Walsh, any closing comments?
Thank you for hearing my testimony. You know, like I said, don't misunderstand me for a second. I love farming. It is deep in my heart. I grew up, we had a sheep farm, we had pigs for a while. This is just, when it is so large, it can hurt the neighbors, and we are hurt by this.
Well, thank you, Ms. Walsh, for your testimony. Thank you for driving the distance as well to be part of the process. It's appreciated. Thank you. Next, we'll have Mr. Schoenfeld. Would you like to come? Please state your name for the record, who you represent. Begin, please.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Jerry Schoenfeld. I work with the Minnesota Pork Producers Association, and we'd like to thank the MDA for the work that they've done on their livestock study, but we think we can add a little bit more to it. If there was a general criticism of the study, it's from us, it would be that it doesn't go deep enough into some of the issues. But in terms of what was done there, there's a lot of good information in there, but we'd like to take it a little further. First of all, one of the things that I kind of start with is that we have often heard, matter of fact, I think the generation of this study was really the idea that probably Representative Miller, I think, had heard from different producers, I'm not sure who, but that there were concerns relative to Minnesota being a good place to put livestock and whether neighboring states, there was a migration from Minnesota to neighboring states and so forth. One of the questions I always ask to myself is Minnesota, for instance, within the livestock report here, states that Minnesota is number two in pork production. And that's a move up from where we were. North Carolina used to be number two, Mr. Chairman, as you well know, and Minnesota is now number two, so we've moved up. And as the study states, there has actually been an increase in the number of animals in Minnesota in pork production. We have about 15 million in Minnesota. So one would say, well, if we're moving up in numbers and we're number two, then everything must be just fine, because that would be a kind of a general thought you might take from that. But there are places for improvement, and there are a lot of things within the study that I think points out, and I know the PCA is going to get up and talk about their permitting system and so forth. Minnesota probably has the most, and as pointed out within the study, the most in-depth permitting system pretty much any place in the country. The costs associated with that permitting system are considerably higher than almost all of our neighboring states, and if you look at the study, they do a very good job of pointing that out. And so I think you've got the actual dollar numbers there and also the steps within the permitting system. And generally that is one of the things that is brought up by livestock producers a lot, that the permitting system is a bit cumbersome. But there must be reasons then why livestock would stay in Minnesota in spite of, not because of, the permitting system in a sense. But in some cases the permitting system, I'll grant, would in some ways might even aid livestock, depending upon what it is and where it is and so forth within the state. But let me tell you why Minnesota is a good place to have hogs. First of all, our feed costs are one of the lowest in the country, as you well know, because we're at the end of the chain, and everything in the United States is pretty much based off of Chicago prices, and dependent upon how close you are to Chicago determines what costs you and what transportation costs you have. And so because feed costs are, you know, anywhere from 60% to 70% of the total costs of pork production, those feed costs are very important. And one of the things that has always been a magnet for Minnesota is the fact that we are in at the end of the chain, and therefore feed costs are one of those things that helps keep livestock production in Minnesota. That's changed somewhat with the introduction of ethanol, as an example, where ethanol becomes a competing factor and the basis and margins for grain have diminished over the years because of that, and that's a good thing. And as most of you know, I also work for the Minnesota Soybean Growers, and we work on biodiesel, and we work on things like producing new mills to produce soybean meal, and that's important as well. But even those things are linked to the livestock production in the state. For instance, some beef has started to come back to the state in some areas because of dried distillers grains, in part, perhaps, that the feed costs have been able to be competitive in that sense. In terms of Minnesota's soybean production, we're very high in soybean production, and because of that, soybean prices are a little lower at the end of the chain. But at the same time, we have good milling facilities for soybean meal. And soybean meal production plants are very dependent upon how close they are to the livestock that consumes that soybean meal, because livestock is the largest consumer of that soybean meal, and so the transportation costs involved with that. So the point is, the more livestock you have, the more likely you're going to have some of these kinds of other agricultural entities, whether it be ethanol plants or biodiesel plants or soybean meal plants, that are all dependent in part upon that livestock flow that you've got. So feed costs. The second one is that, as Mr. Chairman, I know that you've got a bill in, for instance, dealing with the vet diagnostic lab this year, and most people here may know that the vet diagnostic lab in Minnesota is one of the better ones in the United States, and that they do a very good job of working with in two areas. In one hand, working with at the University of Minnesota to control disease within the pork industry. It's very important to the industry. In addition to that, producing people that can go out into the countryside, and we have a very involved veterinarian community as such with production of livestock in Minnesota. In many cases, through ownership as an example. In some of these are part ownership, but very involved with a lot of the pork facilities, and that is something that's very good because disease is a huge factor in terms of pork production. Third, we have diversity of ownership. Many years ago in this state, we had an anti-corporate farm law that was very restrictive. Basically, at that time, the only people that could own livestock were individual farmers. But the model for livestock, particularly pork production, has changed tremendously over the years, partly because of biosecurity. And within the MDA study, it mentions split housing or split sites that are used in livestock production, and it's a biosecurity tool. It's used in order to stop. My comparison is I have a granddaughter, Mr. Chairman, that I take pictures with me all over, but she goes to a nursery school. I call it the germ pit because all of those little kids get together and it seems like she's coming home with a cold all the time. In the old days, we used to raise livestock where people would go to four different places to buy feeder pigs, and they would throw them together just like those kids in that nursery school, and they would all get sick. Today we use split site housing in which animals come in all in one group. They go to the next site on a different farm and a different group and perhaps a third site even. And that's part of biosecurity. It's part of the way we manage diseases in livestock, and hopefully along with that reduce the amount of use of antibiotics that we've per animal and so forth that has been involved in it. So that ownership model, that whole system the fact that Minnesota changed its corporate farm laws some years ago did provide for more flexibility, and we probably have as diverse a ownership of livestock in Minnesota that provides more opportunities of any place around. Beyond that, there's another part of that ownership, and it deals with risk. In my lifetime, I've seen hogs at 9 cents, and that's a devastating time period. That was back in the 1980s. One of the things that the reason farmers kind of got out of hog raising was the risk involved. And so part of this is an ownership model that provides for risk management. And, Mr. Chairman, I know you're with the group that does that. And the last is proximity to processing, which is also in the MDA report. But I want to tell you, if you take a look at the page within the MDA report that talks about processing, they show many, many different dots on a map. And those dots represent individual entities that process livestock. But most of those dots are pretty small facilities. The Nicollet Locker plant is an example. I represent Clark smiling. He's probably done over there in Boston Sausage. But the point is, most of those are probably a little bit more closer to Minnesota-grown kind of facilities in many cases. But I want to point out the large facilities in Minnesota. We do have three facilities in Minnesota one of which is in Austin, Minnesota, that all of you know, Hormel's. They process about 20,000 head per day. Worthington is number two. They process about 20,000 head per day. And the reason I point this out is because there's nothing in the NDA report that speaks to the capacity of these plants. And the capacity is probably more important than how many dots you have on a map. Beyond that, there is a third one which will be opening, I think, this fall, and that is at Wyndham, that will process about 20% of the hogs in the state that will be processed, and that's 4,000 at Wyndham. And that's transferring from a beef processing plant to a pork. So beef is going to lose out on that when pork opens up. However, having mentioned those three major plants, we only process 50% of the hogs that are produced in Minnesota. The other 50% goes outside of the state. And, Mr. Chairman, if you tap in your watch, I'll be glad to leave if that's a problem. Is it getting to be a problem? I just wanted to give you an in-depth view of this processing situation. About 50% of the hogs leave the state. There are two new plants that are originating in Iowa within the coming year. One is in Mason City, will come online in about 2018. It'll employ about 2,000 people. Their starting wages will be $15 an hour plus benefits. And they will have two shifts of 10,000 apiece. And in Sioux City, the same thing in summer of 2017, and they have 20,000 hogs that they'll be processing and employing about 2,000 people. The reason I bring this up is because those seem to me two missed opportunities for Minnesota. Would have been nice if those plants had been in Minnesota rather than in a neighboring state. But they are close enough to our hog production that we can add a lot of people in there. The other is at Sioux Falls, South Dakota, about 20,000 there. And we also have five other plants in Iowa that take in Minnesota hogs. And some of our hogs, like down Rock County in southwestern Minnesota, it's just as close to go to St. Joe, Missouri, as it or northwestern or northeastern Nebraska as it is to go to Austin. So some of the hogs end up going down those kinds of areas. So I wanted to point out that if you take a look, I think the map in the thing here is a little misleading as to where all those livestock facilities are. The other thing I would mention, I wanted to quickly mention, is that relative to the processing of the numbers of hogs that are increasing, within the document it talks about a number of increasing hogs within Minnesota. But in the last, I think it was just last week, the new USDA livestock report came out, or hog report came out, pig and hog report. One of the things to point out was that Minnesota was down 10,000 hogs, down 10,000 hogs, whereas South Dakota was increased, Iowa was increased, and so forth. The reason I point that out is that I misspoke, Mr. Chairman, not 10,000 hogs, but 10,000. We're down about 10,000 sows. That's what I meant to say. And the point is that there are two sides of hog production in Minnesota. One is the sow production, where the feeder pigs are produced, and the other is the finishing side. The reason I point this out is because in many cases, the sow production is a bigger problem with regard to permitting, and at least it is from our standpoint. And so when you look at some of the permitting things, it may have a bigger factor than that. But Minnesota is actually down on that side of things. And I don't
about
think that's
five more
out.
Minutes, Mr.
Okay.
Chong.
I don't think that's pointed out. The last thing I would mention to you is that one of the other things the report probably could have used a little bit more was our feed mill capacity in the state, because that's very important. It has to be within 50 to 60 miles of the animals itself. In addition to that, I think the previous testifier talked about a nuisance lawsuit. If you read the report, it kind of indicates that there's really not much going on in that area. But in fact, in Iowa, the same law firm, I think, that's bringing the one, I think I'm correct, I'm not certain about this, but I think I'm correct, the ones that's bringing it in Todd County has also got 13 or 14 suits going on in Iowa. And this does have potential to have a big impact. We do have a nuisance lawsuit law as such, but it has big impact should the courts change some of the factors involved with that. And so it's something that needs to be paid attention to. The last thing is the recommendations of the report. And basically, if you read the recommendations, they're fairly general and kind of suggest we should continue to support our livestock industry, but not a lot of detail as to how that might take place. And we think that there could be some additional things there that could be talked about. The very last thing I wanted to mention, just because of the previous testifier and I know the PCA is going to come up here and they're going to talk about a lot of things. Minnesota does have a very extensive permitting situation in Minnesota, and sometimes that can be helpful and sometimes it's not. Sometimes I'll give it that it can be helpful in terms of making sure sites are in the proper place and so forth. But there is an awful lot of input that takes place along that permitting system, starting with conditional use permits, notifications within our state law that within 5,000 feet, all landowners must be notified before anything goes forward. You have townships, which almost no other states have got, in terms of being able to come in and put in moratoriums. And at one time, we had over 100 townships with moratoriums. We have 70-20 rules that you must comply with, manure management plans, building permits, And then if you're over 1,000 animal units, you have EAWs, NPDS, or SDS permits. In addition to that, you have hydrogen sulfide potential monitoring at the borders, ammonia, and then, of course, a well permit as well. And that's been recently one of the things that has kind of come into play, than anything over a million gallon usage, which is about 3,000 finishing hogs and about 1,000 sows, if give some idea of that. So all of these things are there. I think it's unfortunate if there is any problems and there occasionally are, with an individual site or something, but there is an awful lot of input there from the public, from the PCA, from the county commissioners, from the townships that are available. And as Representative Clark pointed out, that's an ongoing kind of a situation as well in many cases. So I don't want to get into a specific lawsuit on nuisance as an example, but I do want to tell you that it's a very big concern to a lot of the livestock industry about what the future of that may be. And it is the other part of that is that in many cases we're starting to see, for instance, where HSUS and other outside parties are joining part in these lawsuits for perhaps reasons that may go beyond the local smell as such. So, Mr. Chairman, thank you for that opportunity, and if there are any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Schoenfeld. Any questions? Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Schoenfeld, thank you. I don't so much have a question as a punctuating point, and then I don't know if there's other questions, but I'll let you go. I appreciate what it is that you just expressed here in the hog industry, because I've heard that with pork. I've also heard it in avian as well as dairy. And I think what you're punctuating is a story that I've heard from literally hundreds of people in the state of Minnesota that are in these different industries. I've been told that I'm just listening to a couple lobbyists and a couple complainers on these things. And I want the committee to hear that this is being talked about it across the state of Minnesota, and that's why I have the concerns. I'm not here to just find fault in things. I honestly believe that that animal livestock production is a very big growth area, particularly for greater Minnesota, and I want to find every way possible to encourage its growth. So I appreciate the statements that you made. I'll have a couple questions a little bit later on when we get through this, but thank you.
Thank you, Representative Miller. Any other questions for the testifier? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Schoenfeld. Next, we'll bring up Ms. Gauthier. If you please state your name, who you represent for the record, and begin, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Greta Gauthier, Legislative Director, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Thank you for having us here to talk about this important issue, and it's a pleasure to be back in front of the Agriculture Committee.
Welcome. We're happy to have you.
Thank you. If it's all right with you, I asked Mr. Huckridey and Mr. Scuda to come up with me. They have some opening remarks about our feedlot permitting process. We also have a couple handouts. I wanted to make sure folks had those available. One is about NPDS and SDS, and a lot of folks on the committee know a lot about that already, but Mr. Chairman, I do know you have some new members on your committee this year, so I wanted to make sure there was good background information. There's also a flow chart that kind of talks about the permitting process and the EAW process and how those line up. And finally, Mr. Chairman, this is the third document is our brand new for 2016, our dashboard from PCA. And I would just direct members to the back page over where it says permits and compliance. It kind of gives you an idea on how we've been progressing in terms of speeding up our permits and the compliance rates we have. We work very hard with the permitted entities to ensure compliance. And the only other overarching comment I would make before I turn it over to the experts here is that, you know, Minnesota does have more natural resource in the form of water to protect than do the states of North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, et cetera. And so being that we are the headwaters of three major watersheds, so the Mississippi River, the Red River of the North, and then the whole Great Lakes St. Lawrence Seaway, you know, we feel a responsibility not only to Minnesotans, and to future farmers, but also to others outside of our state, that we do our job and do the best we can do according to the law to protect the water so it's here for future people in Minnesota. With that, I'll turn it over to Randy Huckwrighty and Glenn Scuda.
Well, thank you. And please, if you just state your name for the record, who you represent, and begin.
Mr. Chair, Glenn Scuda. I'm the director of the Watershed Division at the Pollution Control Agency. You may be more used to seeing Galen Reitz in this seat. He retired a month ago, so I'm replacing him. But happy to be with you today to answer questions that you have. And Randy Huckwrighty, our program manager of our feedlot program out of our Wilmer office, will be providing most of the testimony.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as Glenn mentioned, my name is Randy Huckwrighty. I'm the program manager of the feedlot program for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. The feedlot program is, I'm sure you know, works with feedlot owners and operators around the state to protect both groundwater and surface water. But as you've heard today, we realize animal agriculture is also a major economic driver for the state. As has been mentioned, we're the number one turkey-producing state, number two in hogs, number six in dairy, and number 12 in cattle and calves. Total livestock and poultry receipts are approximately $9.6 billion per year. In addition, we also recognize that a livestock industry really helps both the diversity of the crops, and it's also good for the environment when properly done. I mean, manure does increase soil health when it's properly managed, builds up organic matter, and it also diversifies the landscape with crops with more perennial crops. In Minnesota, to give you an idea of the scope, we have approximately 24,000 registered feedlots. And a feedlot's required to register if they have 50 or more animal units outside of shoreland or 10 or more animal units in shoreland. Now, one animal unit is equal to approximately 1,000-pound animals, so a 1,000-pound cow, for instance, would be one animal unit, a 300-pound pig, approximately 0.3 animal units. Now, of the approximately 24,000 registered feedlots that we have, during the last permitting cycle, we issued 1,367 NPDES permits. Now, of that number, 1,311 were general permits and 56 were individual permits. Now, when you look at it by sector, approximately 73% of those permits were issued to swine facilities, 14% to poultry, 7% beef and cattle, and about 6% dairy. You've got a flow chart that kind of provides a high-level view of how the permit process works. So I'm not going to go into a lot of detail there, but basically when a permit comes in the door, we do an initial check on that permit packet, if you will, to make sure all the major components are in that packet. Did they submit plans and specs, for instance, if they're building, manure management plans, etc. After that initial, what we call a component completeness check, the packet's then sent on to our technical staff where they'll do a more in-depth technical review. At this point, we generally work very closely with the producer or their consultant to make sure that anything that's not technically complete in that application is submitted as soon as possible. From there, we go to a mandatory 30-day public notice period, and then at the end of the 30-day public notice period, respond to any applicable comments, and then the permit is issued. Now, to help feedlot owners move through the permit process as efficiently as possible, we do produce numerous fact sheets, we do outreach at producer trade shows and other meetings, and we also provide a lot of technical assistance both on the phone and on site. To give you an idea, the results of these efforts are really, I think, reflected in the permit issuance time. Looking back approximately 4 years, our permits on average have been issued in 47 business days from the receipt of a component complete application. So once it makes it through with all the major components in place and moves to technical review, 47 days later on average the permit is issued. I think it's important to note within that 47 days, there's a 30-day public notice period that's required, and then approximately 30 days working with the permittee. So if you look at it, calendar days, we're at 68 calendar days, 47 business days. You've heard a little bit about some of the benefits of having a permit. I'd just like to highlight a couple of those again. It is a very, I think, proactive process. We work really closely with the owners, operators, and their consultants to make sure that problems are anticipated or any potential problems are anticipated ahead of time, and they can put in place the appropriate plans to deal with, say, spills, odors, and then manure management's a key part of that, but making sure they have a manure management plan that really shows how they're going to test the manure, where it's going to be applied, and how they're going to make sure they follow all the applicable requirements to minimize any environmental impact. A second point is, with an NPDES permit, it also provides a future liability reduction from lawsuits over potential discharges that may occur. So in closing, I just wanted to stress again, the feedlot program wants to ensure the sustainability of livestock and poultry operations and work with them to make sure that we ensure the environment is not protected, is protected and not impacted. So with that, I'll if you have any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer those.
Thank you, Mr. Hook-Reed. Any questions? Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've heard from a couple of cow-calf producers that they run their cows on various pastures throughout the summer and then bring those cows back home to a kind of a winter range for the winter time period and feed those cows there and maybe calve them out there in the spring as well. But there seems to be a feeling that MPCA would like to more regulate these cow-calf guys when they bring their cows home in the fall and put them maybe on a 40 or an 80 or cornfield over the wintertime, and like the infiltration is increasing as far as regulating this type of operation. Could you comment on that and what's your thinking on these cow calf operators?
Hook-Reed?
Chair members, within the 70-20 rules, first off, the agency doesn't regulate pastures. I think, you know, that's been stated in the past. But the cow-calf operations that you talk about, generally speaking, the density of those operations is quite low. As you mentioned, they might put those cattle out on 40 to 80 acres of field. So we haven't really seen issues or problems, you know, with those. We encourage, you know, those types of operations, particularly the pasture operations. So I think the main issue is just is maintaining the good low enough density so that you don't create feedlot conditions out on the winter area.
Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So no intent to regulate these producers more closely as long as they don't make feedlot conditions and have some cover on that ground over the wintertime?
Mr. Hook-Reed.
Chair, members, yes, that's correct.
Thank you. Chair Anderson. Any other questions? Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hook-Reed, thanks for coming out, and MPCA, thank you for coming out here. I've met with some of the people already, and I'd love to meet a little bit more because this is this permitting is a bit perplexing to me. And rather than get into the weeds on that, I will make a statement, but rather than get into the weeds, I have some potential solutions I want to ask if you could think about. Because I hear the 45 days, I hear if, you know, things are done properly. I know that there are people that work on this with production, with farmers, with larger companies and stuff. They have actual staff that does this. And yet, I hear the official statistic numbers, but then I hear almost entirely from everyone I talk to that the permitting process here in Minnesota is at the very least, in contrast to the other states, very difficult and problematic. But what I hear more is it's very discouraging and a bit of an antagonistic relationship. So I guess I'd like to know from your perspective why I'm hearing that consistently, and I guess my bigger question for you is if I hear the earnestness of the MPCA saying we want to make sure that certain standards are met, but also allowing for these producers to be able to do what they want to do. Is there some way that we can look at, for example, if you have existing producers that already have permits on certain facilities and stuff like that, if there's some sort of fast-tracking process that we can go of saying they've already, they meet a certain level of standards and best management practices, some of these different things. We kind of know they're doing things already, so get us the right paperwork to kind of finish off and round off the curves and or round off the corners, and then perhaps we can do that. So can you kind of, I guess what I'm asking overall is can you address why there still appears to be a struggle with so many producers and ways in which you believe the MPCA can help kind of fix those perspectives and those attitudes and those problems that people have?
Mr. Hookreed.
Yes, Chair, members. I guess I'm not really seeing or hearing from a lot of people that are having a great deal of difficulty going through the permitting process, but we're always open to look at ways to improve the process. You know, we do focus on any sites where there are construction activities going on and put those at the top of the queue to make sure that, you know, somebody that is looking at constructing a new site or modifying an existing site, that those permits are processed, you know, as efficiently and as quickly as possible. But if you have got additional suggestions, you know, I'd be more than willing to talk to you about those.
And I'd love to talk, Mr. Chair, thank you, and I'd love to talk about those. I think one of the challenges that I may have just come to my mind now is when I ask people, have you talked to, let's say, for example, you, sir, or someone else about these concerns, and I'm just being frank with you here. That's why we have this study. There's concern, there's consternation, there's even fear that if they talk that there's going to be problems. Now, I'm not talking about repercussions. I don't think there's that level of fear, but there's really kind of an attitude of it isn't going to help anyway, or I fear if I do this it's just going to create more problems for me and stuff like that. And that may be perception. When I met with the group last week, that may be perception, but us as government have the responsibility then to change that perception, not the industry. And so that's some of the areas that I would like to discuss. Also, if there's ways that we can, where it makes sense, streamline the system. When I look at a flow chart like this, if this happens every single time you want to open a new barn, that's too much work. And you have people that have been operating for a long time that do things the right way, and I just think this is rather burdensome and costly to be able to do this. So I would very much welcome talking about that with you in the future.
Mr. Hookreed, do you want to comment on that? Or?
Chair, members, yes, I'd welcome those discussions, so feel free to, you know, contact me or Mr. Scuda, and we'd be happy to meet some more with you.
And Mr. Chair, heard properly, you're in Wilmer?
Yes, I am in Wilmer.
Okay, we'll meet sometime soon. Thank
yes.
you.
Very nice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
To the testifier, say I had a very nice meeting with Commissioner John Linkstein here. This was maybe even over a year ago. And we were talking about, you know, the permitting process. And, you know, there's good reasons to have a permit. And I don't think people dispute that. If they do, they probably shouldn't be in the business, right? That's not the concern. Like Representative Miller said, that there are entities out there that have people on staff that know and understand the permitting process. For instance, I know of one that has 8 agronomists on staff. They have a member that they hired from the Pollution Control Agency to make sure that they're 100% in accordance with all the rules and regulations. But not everybody can do that. There are many, many wonderful farmers out there that's what they want to do. They want to farm, right? And they don't have access to that. In that meeting that I had with the commissioner, I said one of the issues that we run into is this horrible game of ping pong back and forth. An individual will submit what they think is a completed application, and they get a response back to from the PCA saying it's not complete, and then back and forth and back and forth. And I said, you know, you can go online and order something from, you name, Amazon, and if you don't properly complete it, a red flag pops up, and your order won't go through until everything is complete. And so I think today's technology, today's day and age, we should be able to have a system in place that would do that. So the average farmer that's applying for a permit would know on the spot, right then and there, that they've provided everything. And the commissioner, like I said, it was a very good conversation that the commissioner and I had. And are we anywhere closer to something like that? Who would like to take that? So, Mr. Hookreed.
Yes, Chair, members of the committee, we're actually going through a fairly major data overhaul, if you will, right now. The second phase of which will be coming online hopefully within the next couple of months, we're looking at having an actual online portal where producers could go in and do exactly what you're talking about, pull up the information, you know, about their facility. It would walk them through applying for the permit and in theory would do exactly what you're saying, not allow a permit to come in unless all the information is in there, and then, you know, would prompt them as well about, you know, what information might be missing or what information they need to supplement their application. So that should go, I think, a long ways too, to maybe demystifying the process a little bit, but also streamlining the process as well for both us and the producers.
Thank you. Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to pick up on that line of questioning because it stirs in my mind, if I'm a small producer and I don't have those eight agronomists and the former staff member with the PCA to help me, that I might get confused, even more confused when I'm on that portal. And so my question is, if I'm a small producer and I'm seeking the permit, who helps me? How do I access that help? How do I know how to access that help?
Mr. Hookery.
Chair, members, there's probably a couple options. We're in 52 of the counties. We have a delegated county feedlot program, and those counties are specifically tasked for working with the smaller producers that you're referring to. So they have a county feedlot officer, in some cases more than one, depending on the number of feedlots in the county. And that's exactly the type of service that they provide, you know, in that area, is to answer those questions about going through the permit and what does it mean. And then we in the non-delegated counties, the remaining ag counties, as much as possible try to provide that same level of service. So I was just on the phone a couple days ago with a gentleman from North Dakota that was looking at coming over here, and was able to kind of walk through the process with him. And then as well, you know, we've got with the Department of Ag, their livestock group over there, that has also been extremely helpful with helping walk those small businesses, small farmers through the process too. So I think, you know, we can always do more, but, you know, we're trying as much as possible to work with those folks one-on-one and get them the information that they need.
Representative Johnson. Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a little bit of a follow-up from on Chair Anderson's question about livestock producers, in particular cattle folks. Are you comfortable that the agency has a clear and understandable definition of when you're in a feedlot situation versus winter feeding, particularly on corn stocks, that type of thing? And I, you know, number of decades ago we went through some painful machinations on finally happened to define for the agency exactly what a pasture was. I think it took about three attempts of statute to, so that everybody could agree on that. I not so sure I agree with you. Maybe you haven't heard much or there's not much going on out there. There does seem to be a periodic issue as to when a corn stock field with cattle being winter fed on it is a feedlot versus when you're just simply winter feeding cattle.
Mr. Hookery.
Chair, members of the committee, you know, we've, without going too far into the weeds, like I said, we've recently came through a Supreme Court case that kind of better defined that, and without going into great level of detail, basically what they looked at was, is there forage on the field and is there ground cover, you know, on the field when those cattle are removed? And so that's a basic threshold that we look at, and that's why, you know, a lot of it does come down to the density that you're stocking that field at. If you keep the density down, cattle numbers down, and or have a large enough area, then you will have, you know, forage and adequate ground cover so that when that spring thaw does come, you're not getting runoff.
Representative Lewick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That may still be an area we may want to pursue over the long haul on whether we've really got a clear definition. And obviously the fact that those type of disagreements ended up at the Supreme Court level would augur that we may have still work to do in that area.
Now, Mr. Hookreed, we took testimony from an individual who is very passionate about a sighting. Walk us through the process. If somebody has a concern or a complaint with a facility, can you walk us through what avenues can they take, what resources do they have in order to get their concerns addressed?
Representative, members of the committee, I guess depending on, you know, the type of complaint, most of them are handled relatively the same, but if we do get a complaint, for instance, in this instance, odor, what we generally will do with those is try to establish that it's, you know, it's an ongoing issue. Generally speaking, we'll have them complete an odor log so we can get some sense of when it's happening. We'll try to get staff out there. We've got Jerome meters that will do some initial field screening to find out, you know, what are the levels of, in this case, hydrogen sulfide that they're finding out there. And if we're starting to see, you know, elevated levels, we do have the ability then to put out a continuous emission monitor to really get regulatory thresholds, if you will, in place. The Jerome meters are basically just a screening tool to see, you know, is it a high level or a low level. And then depending on what we see with those results, we might have to employ a continuous emission monitor, which would actually provide hydrogen sulfide levels to determine if they're above or below, you know, the regulatory thresholds.
And Mr. Hookreed, in the event those hydrogen, it's hydrogen sulfide, in the event the hydrogen sulfide levels exceed the state law, what would be the next step?
Chair, members of the committee, the next step generally would be to work with, you know, the site that's producing that hydrogen sulfide to see what sort of mitigation measures could be installed. You know, she mentioned biofilters for hog sites. That's a common mitigation practice that would be put in place. So that would be kind of the next step in the process, would be to work with that facility and find out what can be done, you know, to lower those limits, and then try to work with them to develop that solution and get it implemented.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hookreed. Representative Bly. Representative Bly stepped out for a moment. Representative Anderson, Mark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Hookreed. Question about the permitting with the MPCA. Has the MPCA ever suspended a permit for non-compliance of any type of issues, say non-installation of biofilters, or are there any other parameters that would give the MPCA cause to suspend a permit?
Ms. Hooker.
Chair, members of the committee, I believe there's only been one permit where we've gone to the degree of actually revoking the permit, and that one I think will be familiar with some of you from a few years back. We had a large dairy facility up in the northwest corner of the state that was producing extremely high levels of hydrogen sulfide, and that facility ultimately did end up, you know, closing down. In general, we try to work with the facilities and, you know, bring them back into compliance, because it's not our intent or our goal to try to close them. But as far as I know, that's the only facility in recent memory that is actually closed as a result of directly compliance issues. And in that case, it was hydrogen sulfide.
Representative Anderson, follow up. Thank you. Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair Hamilton.
I'm sorry I called on you, but
constituents grabbed me.
Wonderful. Please.
So sorry about that. I'm not sure if you have an answer for my question or not, but perhaps a comment as well. But I was, as I was riding up to the Capitol this morning, I happened to hear a story on NPR where they were talking about a recommendation from the late Kurt Vonnegut on what kind of administrative help we needed at the presidential level. And he said perhaps a cabinet member should be appointed who would be the chair of the future. And they started asking people around the country what kind of things this Department of the FIND-B, the problem of nitrates in our water. And he was saying that, I think it was a person from the University of Minnesota who was saying that one of the issues is that with the move to a landscape that is mostly soy and corn, that's a problem for nitrates. And it's a problem necessarily not necessarily the fault of farmers, but the way that our the agricultural industry has developed and incentivized corn and soybeans so that that's what farmers grow, and that it might be good if we could find a way to incentivize farmers to diversify what they grow on the landscape more, and that would improve water quality. And, you know, as I reflected on this as I was driving up here, I can remember farmers being encouraged to get bigger or get out of farming, and what I'm gathering is perhaps that wasn't the best plan necessarily for our water system if we look at what's happened to farming and how difficult it is with the very large farms to make a change in our improving our water quality. Caused me to think that, you know, that we're hearing that this is an important economic development, having more livestock on the land, for instance. And I guess I wonder, as we think about large feedlots and our water quality, if it is a good idea to encourage and increase the number of feedlots that we might have, even though it may be a good economic development. I guess I'm asking that question perhaps because I want to help people look at that as well. I'm wondering if, as you look at water quality, if it enters into your assessment, not only permitting individual farmers who are developing a feedlot, but looking at the total number of feedlots in a certain area. I think one of the things that's kind of confusing about, you know, for me as I look at a feedlot, and I mean, when you have land with animals on the land, you can have a better sense of when you've exceeded the number of land that the amount of animals that land can handle, that environment can respond to in a positive way. And when you increase that in an artificial kind of environment that doesn't totally stop the interchange between that feedlot and the environment and nature, you lose that sense of where are we here? And how well can we regulate, or how well can we protect the water from growing numbers of feedlots? I guess that's a question that I have for you.
And Mr. Hookreed, when you're answering that question, comment on the manure management plans as well, if you would, please. Mr. Scuda, right?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Bly. First of all, representing you, invoked one of my favorite authors. Thank you. I would point you to, if you're not already familiar with the nitrogen study that our agency put out a couple of years ago, and one of the primary findings of that was where we are seeing the most problem with nitrates in groundwater is really where we have row crop agriculture over tile. And that stands to reason that's where you're going to get that infiltration of nitrate into groundwater. In terms of the manure component of that, and I'll let Randy talk more about our manure management plans in detail, but that's what having manure management plans for livestock operations is all about, is ensuring that, you know, there's a lot of manure generated by these facilities. The larger the facility, the more the manure, to make sure that we're really applying the right amount of manure in the right places and at the right time. And that's what a plan is at its core all about, so that we're not over applying and leading to either ground or surface water contamination from over application or improper application of manure.
Mr. Hookreed.
Chair, members of the committee, excuse me, I don't have a lot of additional data. I think Glenn said it quite nicely, but that's really what we look at as part of the permitting process, is does their manure management plan have, you know, an adequate land base? Are they applying it at the correct methods? We'll also look at when they're out in the fields, are they following the applicable setbacks? Are they incorporating it where it needs to be incorporated, near waters or tile intake? So what we're trying to do is really, you know, proactively on the front end, make sure that they're planning correctly to avoid issues, and then when they're actually out applying the manure, making sure that they're following all the setbacks and to again minimize the impact on both groundwater and surface water.
Thank you, Mr. Hookreed. And Representative Bly, or to the PCA, if you do a corn soybean rotation, you actually have to have twice the amount of acres signed up in order to obtain a permit, correct? That you'd need, because if you're applying the manure, for instance, on soybeans for the following crop being corn acres, if your permit calls for 400 acres of soybean acres, you'd actually need a total of 800 acres signed up for your permit if you're doing corn and soybean rotation. Is that an accurate statement?
Representative members, basically, yes. I mean, we'll have to look at, you know, what are the current levels of the nitrogen and phosphorus in the soil. But in general, yes, you're going to need, you know, some additional acres to account for any carryover from previous applications and then crop removal. And it gets into a lot of agronomic science that I'm not going to go into right here, but you're basically correct. You do need excess acres to make sure you're properly applying it at agronomic rates.
And I think that's important to Representative Bly's concern about if there's a consolidation. It's the manure management plan that would limit the amount of livestock in any general area because you need that acres to apply the nutrients of the manure. So that's manure management plans catch a lot of that. Any follow-up or something? Thank you, Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to get back to the topic of livestock facilities and the nuisance aspect of it, nuisance lawsuits. I think the question we're kind of dancing around here is has to do with what Mish Walsh talked about this morning. And I've talked to people that live up in the area, and they say it's a well-run facility. So we have this difference of opinion. And again, she made it sound like the owners weren't cooperative and the MPCA wasn't out there taking odor levels, things like that. Talk to us about, and maybe you can't, being it's a case still in the court system, but what do you do in cases like that? And have you checked noise levels? Are they under the standards we have for hydrogen sulfide? And what has been done out there at this location?
Mr. Hookreed?
Yes, Chair, members of the committee. I would have to go back and kind of look at the history of the site, you know, and I don't know right now exactly what's been done, but in general, when we get those types of complaints, we go through, like I said, a fairly standard protocol of investigating with the drone meter and then seeing what those levels are. But I'd be happy to, you know, pull that information together and get that back to you with kind of a history or chronology, I guess, of what we've received for complaints and then you know, what's been done or follow-up that's been done.
Chair Anderson?
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. Yeah, this particular situation has been going on, at least to my knowledge, for well over a year, so I would assume you'd have some kind of case history and background of what's been done. So I would appreciate any information you could give us on that particular location.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For Mr. Scooter or Mr. Hookreed, whoever would like to answer this, one of the things that is, it's kind of said in different ways, but one of the things that's plainly said is in the next 20 years, the world is going to need about double the protein production that we currently have. So do either of you have suggestions as to how we produce that protein?
Mr. Hookreed, or who would like to take that? Mr. Scuda?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's not really within our sphere. I'd point back to the department's report that had some recommendations on some, you know, various options for improvement.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Representative Miller.
Okay, thank you. And I guess I apologize if I put you on the spot. I didn't expect you to have an answer to that, but it sort of points out the point that I want to make, that I would put the challenge to the MPCA, Department of Agriculture, and to industry people that want to partner with this. One of the challenges that we have in government right now is we have a silo effect to where we have the needs and desires of a specific agency saying this is what we need to do. And specific to agriculture, where I feel the most pressure on this issue comes from either the MPCA or in some context the DNR, and in some cases Bowser. So we have different agencies. And we can raise the issues to where we say, well, we shouldn't do this, or we can't do this, or this is the direction we have to go. But there's the plain fact is the world needs food, and state of Minnesota is blessed with ideal conditions to produce that food. and yet we seem to be addressing ways to contain and restrict the ability to grow that food. So if the way that we're doing it right now with too much corn and too much soybean is the problem, which I disagree with, but if that's the problem, I would strongly encourage us as a state to work together to figure out a way to solve the problem that does address the issues of water, but also addresses the issues that we need to increase the protein, we need to increase the food stocks, because right now, all we're doing is addressing the water, and I really fear that we are reaching that point, the nexus by which we are going to start seeing real reductions in food production like you've seen in Western Europe, to where now Western Europe has to import everything from Eastern Europe. Now you have food security problems. You also have world food problems. We have some, when you get into some issues like GMOs and stuff like that, which is not what we're here to talk about, you then run into, I just understand, one of the African nations now officially said they're going to restrict all these different conditions on whether they'll take food, and their nation is starving. And so you can't deal with all those world issues. I appreciate that fact, but my encouragement to the MPCA, where your purveyance is, where your realm is, where your silo is, I strongly encourage you to work with the Department of Agriculture, work with industry, and figure out a way that we can produce better, more healthy, nutritious food to feed the world. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Miller. Mr. Hookreed, I brought a drone meter up to St. Paul. I sat at a bus stop and ran a drone meter, and they were out of compliance. I also sat outside of cities who have municipalities, these earthen basins for human waste, and they're out of compliance. How does the PCA address those?
Chair, committee members, within the feedlot program, I can speak to that, but I'd have to get somebody from that does more of that monitoring at those types of sites to speak to the follow-up on those. So if you'd like, I can have somebody get back in touch with you about the hydrogen sulfide odor monitoring at the agency, but I can't really speak to the situations at a city or potentially at a bus stop.
Thank you. I respect that. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I would like to thank you for pointing out earlier the challenges with animal ag. But we've had this conversation here, when people are looking to expand operations, isn't it sometimes that they're looking to be able to use the manure process for fields that are maybe distant to what they already have? Or the other one is to update the facilities they have now so that it lends itself to biosecurity for, say, a hog operation with all the diseases. So as farmers are looking to maybe not so much expand their operation, but to be able to facilitate a better usage of the manure and their biosecurity, that they're doing that expansion.
Mr. Hookery?
Chairman, members of the committee, we have seen some migration north with some of the hog facilities, and that's been one of the primary reasons, as you heard earlier, was the biosecurity issue. You also mentioned maybe applying manure at fields long distances away. That's a practice that has gone on for quite a long time. They have both tankers and tow hoses that they will oftentimes, take manure 2, 3, 4 miles from possibly where it's generated, and then land apply it at, the correct rates. And we do have oversight there as well, during the pumping and the removal of the manure to make sure that that's done safely as well. But it's not uncommon for, the manure to be trucked and or pumped, for several miles from the facility to get to the land where it's ultimately applied.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just personally would like to point out, too, that I think there is more diversification going on. I think farms are looking to do, at least I'm seeing it in my neighborhood, they might have cattle, they might have hogs. They're looking to do a little bit differently on their farms and going back to a little more diversification than rather just, I live in a very crop-oriented area of Minnesota, But I have seen some expansion of livestock, and I know there's some real concerns about it. And of course, I do come from where that last litigation was, so heard all about it, and that's very unfortunate. But I would like to say that I know that farmers that have animals really do pride themselves on trying to keep things clean. It's really unfortunate to hear that this issue is happening, and hopefully there can be some resolution for Ms. Walsh. Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Keel. Any other questions? Ms. Gothier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to represent Keel's question, last, just to point out for your memory, a lot going on these days. Last year, the agency, we did work very closely with Minnesota pork producers, our feedlot program, with our delegated counties, in order to put together a program that would facilitate truck washing facilities to meet biosecurity needs. And I do know that Commissioner Stein is very concerned about biosecurity, as we all are, and want to do our part to make sure that we are meeting those needs. So we did work on that bill last year, did get passed into law, so that's out there now.
Thank you, Ms. Gothier. Any other questions, members? Any other questions? Any closing comments? Well, any for the PCA or in general? We'll open it up to in general. We have less than 10 minutes, so we have to make it over to the Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll try to take a stab at it. And I think you found from my comments earlier, and this is true last year as well, I think we certainly want a vibrant livestock industry in Minnesota. I could talk for hours about that. But we also have to be sensitive to the environmental concerns, but also the neighborhood concerns. It's interesting that Representative Miller hears from livestock producers who have trouble siting a barn or whatever, expanding. I hear, frankly, from the reverse. I hear from people who have lived in the countryside and families who lived there 150 years when a barn comes in, and if it's not done well, that's where the complaints come. But what strikes me mostly, especially in hog producing, is that modern hog farming, and modern dairies too, that I'm aware of, have really made significant advances. And there's an opportunity to expand in the livestock industry and to do it well. It takes time, it takes energy. Yes, there's some costs involved, but I still adhere to the idea that when we do that well, the costs are less, there's more harmony on the countryside, and really working to do that well, that's where we get that stable, strong livestock industry, really, that is described in this report. And so I think staying on the path, improving what we're doing, but remembering that balance as we go, I think is critical to the future of the livestock industry in Minnesota.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My final comment really is not directed at the agencies here, but to the DNR. One of your bullet points on page 5 of the report talks about establishing more conservation acres, working lands, things like that. A couple of years back, we told the DNR to work with cattlemen, again, I'm talking about cattle people, to allow them in certain areas to graze some of our state lands. And it seems to be, again, a win-win situation. They don't have to burn the land off, which is about, what, $50 an acre, we were told. So in some areas it works real well. And the practice is really taken off on federal fish and wildlife land. But again, talking to the folks back in my area, the DNR, for whatever reason, has kind of put the brakes on letting cattlemen graze on some of our state land. And I talked to the area wildlife manager, and what they had come up with was a higher standard for fencing, and to make the farmer put up a four-wire permanent fence was pretty expensive, and it was just bothersome, and it just didn't work. And they were going to look at going back to a more portable type fence, a one or two wire electric fence, and hopefully allow more of this good practice on some of our state grasslands. And that would go a long way, I think, to one of your bullet points of having more conservation acres, working lands, to combine this wildlife and some livestock production on some of these lands. And again, it would be a win-win situation, but it was a DNR that had kind of put the brakes on that practice and hopefully now is coming back to allow it to a greater extent. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions or comments, I want to thank everybody for the thoughtful discussion. And with that, we are adjourned.